Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lee, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI. And today, we're going to discuss anger. So, Alistair, do we live in an age of rage?
Perhaps, and perhaps because the age of rage started with the very beginning of the Western tradition. So the Iliad, the first word of the Iliad is menin, which is from menis, which roughly translates as wrath. It's often translated as wrath, but it can be translated as anger. And the Iliad starts with this sing of the rage of Achilles. And actually, the Iliad, which is called by Simone Weil the poem of force, is actually, a lot of it is about anger. In the sense that menis, again, it doesn't translate particularly well into English, but where it often happens, this kind of overwhelming anger, this thing that grips human beings, it happens because of some transgression. So Achilles initially gets very angry because the king Agamemnon takes away his slave girl. And, again, we're talking about very different. We're talking about mythical beings here. Achilles is semi-divine. We're talking about a completely pre-modern society. So, you know, I'm certainly not getting angry about those kinds of issues. But Achilles is. So, and what menis does in the poem, it sort of releases this terrible force in the world. Achilles becomes a kind of tool of divine anger. And it becomes a kind of way of working out transgression. And even in the Iliad, there are lots of concerns about anger. Achilles is not a straightforward character. He, when he's consumed by this semi-divine rage, he can't sleep, he can't eat, he behaves in a near bestial manner. He starts ignoring all kinds of moral codes. So he stops giving any mercy to people he's about to kill. He kills people in sort of degrading ways. So even in the Iliad, which is about mythical warriors having it out, in which you might expect anger to be seen as a pretty productive, helpful emotion, you know, getting up for battle, avenging your friends. Even in the Iliad, anger is a complex thing that is not morally neutral. It's something that people are concerned about. It's something that pushes us to the limits. It's something that reveals extreme emotional states, which are seen as not helpful. If I can put it that way, the age of rage is something that's always been with us. We're always trying to negotiate anger. We're always trying to work out when it's helpful and when it's not so helpful.
One thing that really strikes me when reading the Iliad, and in fact a lot of ancient Greek and indeed Roman works, is the level of violence that's involved there, the visceral nature, the kind of bone-crunching, blood-curdling kind of nature of that violence. And it really strikes me as a very pre-Christian violence. And I've always had a slight issue with anger because I don't get very angry. And I know that this is an age of rage. I've always subscribed to the idea attributed to Arthur Balfour that nothing matters very much and few things matter at all. And it is this idea, I think, of violence, that this anger that rages within one, which is about caring. And I've always thought it may even be a kind of deep fault of mine that I don't have this deep kind of commitment to anything in particular that's really anything other than superficial. So that may well make me superficial. But I am aware of anger as a positive thing. There's no passion, I think it was Montaigne who wrote brilliantly on anger, who says there's no passion that so much transports men from their right judgment as anger. So that's a very negative way of putting it. But when we see it in the Iliad, and I think of things for which it is positive, I think of the wrath of Achilles. It's good to be angry if one is a soldier, one is a warrior. W.H. Auden, in a particularly brilliant and perceptive article, essay on anger, says that anger, even when it's sinful, And there we have that kind of Christian notion of anger being sinful, certainly one of the seven deadly sins there. It has one virtue. It overcomes sloth. You know, it does enable people. It does thrust people forward. And I think we think of when Malcolm speaks to Macduff in Macbeth, he says, let grief convert to anger, blunt not the heart. It's a kind of enabling emotion at its best, but it's also one that I think if we go back to Montaigne, it is one that just eats away and eats away and eats away. And that's the kind of problem with it, is it becomes both an enabling one, perhaps in an extreme situation, like soldiering, like the life of the warrior, but in everyday life, it's immensely destructive. And that's what we seem to have an age of rage about very little, that there's a kind of narcissistic element to modern anger.
Well, to put the other view, which emerges primarily in Seneca, who hates anger, if he can said to hate anything, he doesn't see any productive uses for anger. So that's the kind of, you know, there are voices in the Western tradition that say anger is completely useless. It doesn't even have one. It doesn't have any virtues. It doesn't have any productive qualities. I mean, Seneca, he wrote a text called De Ira on anger, and he begins by calling it the most hideous and frenzied of all the emotions. He just sees no value in it. And why does he see no value in it? He takes on, Paul, that view that anger can be useful for soldiers. He sort of says, yeah, and I'm sort of glossing this, that if the thing you were worth fighting for was that important, you shouldn't have to use anger to get yourself up to fight about it. It should be something that you see in a cold light. It's something that you do because of duty or because of some conscience or some, this a sort of fundamental duty towards others. It should be seen with an element of distance. Seneca returns over and over again, and you know, again, just to bring, who is Seneca? He's someone who's known as a philosopher in the Stoic tradition, which is one of the sort of three traditions of ancient philosophy, along with, you know, things like Epicureanism. But Stoicism, you know, has this view that that certain emotions are just really not useful, and that there should always be this kind of distance between the self and kind of extreme emotions. Again, that's really glossing it. But Seneca, what comes up in his writing over and over again, and he's writing in the Neronian period, he was Nero's tutor, so he probably is aware of what anger can do to people. But he's obsessed with the Colosseum. He always comes back to this, the metaphor of gladiators and the crowd. He hates going to the Colosseum because what he sees in the Colosseum, and he writes about it in On Anger, is people sort of losing their cool over and over again about things which are fundamentally not really to do with them. Yep. So he sort of goes, why is the crowd getting so resentful of the gladiators who beg for mercy? You know, this is just so... it's this great bit, actually, where he sort of goes, you know, that we shouldn't be making such quick judgments about the complexities of life. We should be viewing things with an element of coolness. Seneca, to invoke a contemporary example, would have hated what happened at Lord's Cricket Ground a couple of weekends ago.
Let's get back to the cricket.
Exactly, let's get back to the cricket. But that's a great example, actually, of what Seneca's talking about. What happens on the pitch is, again, debatable. It's a cricket match for England, Australia. Australia do a bit of sharp practice. The England batsman gets out, and the crowd goes absolutely mad. People are furious. You know, yeah, you could see the way in which some of the members of the cricket club were shouting at the Australian yes, players.
Ruddy-faced, I think it's fair to say.
Exactly, aggressive, ruddy-faced. Mm. Seneca would have said, no, you know, this is sort of nothing to do with you. Just view it with a kind of detachment, see it for what it is. Don't get so involved and so riled up, because it distorts the face. It creates this terrible external thing which poisons everything. And I think that's what Seneca's interested in. That anger has an external influence, which we cannot control. It's not just an internal decision. When we get angry, it affects other people and it affects the way they see us. And this is very dangerous.
But which we should control. Mm. I mean, you've gone back to the origins of Western literature, of Western philosophy. But I think maybe we go back to the beginning of life. There's something very childlike about anger. You know, the first time you ever see someone really screaming with anger is always a toddler or a child who hasn't really explored or has no real handle on the framework of life, on the way that, and can't handle expectations because they don't know what the expectations are of themselves or their relationship to other people. They have a lack of language skills, and we've spoken here before about the way we may be entering a post-literate society in some way. One wonders whether it's a lack of articulacy that often promotes anger. Interesting that Keir Starmer, for example, has talked about this idea of oracy. I mean, a dreadful word, but the idea of articulating ideas, of being able to speak properly, of being able to just be articulate and be able to profess ideas, to consider ideas, to consider nuance. All these seem to be things that are, I don't want to sound like a pessimist here or especially conservative about these things, but there does seem to be a lack of literacy in the wider public sphere. Now, I think this has been promoted by social media, of course. There's much less space in which to promote ideas and to have the kind of nuance. If we look at the parochialism of much news reporting, for example, that focuses on the sensational rather than the long-form story, the real deep analysis, and we seek fixes, easy answers. We've seen that rage in Trumpian kind of populism that sees everything in a kind of Manichaean black and white way, rather than deal with the innate tragedy of what it is to be human.
And I think to come back to that kind of idea of a post-literate society, we may actually be returning to a vision of anger that is closer to the vision illustrated in the Iliad, which kind of sees anger as a feature of the cosmic order, as something that pervades relationships, that is sort of something that is inflicted on us and we are just carried along with it. And I think that that's actually, it's not just true of people who are engulfed in a kind of populist anger at their situation, but also about the responses to that populist anger that you've seen over the last decades. Diagnoses of the age of political rage, really directed often at people, but by commentators at people they just disagree with, often seem to think of anger as something that is just in the water, in the air. It's something that just is not something that we can really control. It's something that people are just almost like animals who are like, you know, responding very viscerally to the anger that they feel out there. And actually, I think that's a real mistake. We should see anger as something that we should, we can deal with if we cultivate our personalities in the right way. It's something that you have to, I think, you know, I always come back to Montaigne on anger. He wrote a brilliant little essay, it's only 8 pages long or something, just on anger, much shorter than Seneca's, you know, 50-70 page monograph on anger. But what Montaigne talks about, he kind of takes the traditional Stoic line at first. He says, oh, anger's just the worst thing. You just can't be angry because it again has this terrible external thing. You simultaneously look terrible and also you don't get what you want. You know, if you're telling someone off and you're really angry with them, they're not even going to believe that what you're telling them off for is something that is justified. They'll just think you're an angry person and ignore you. So anger, you know, for Montaigne, he kind of takes the traditional line at first, but then he sort of goes, well, in a very Montaigne way, it's a hard one because sometimes you do get angry and that you do get peevish and you do get, you know, especially as a kind of older man, Montaigne's writing in it kind of in a kind of mature stage of his life, and he lives in near Bordeaux. He has this estate. He's dealing with lots of variety of people. He doesn't really like managing his estate. It's something that comes out in his writing a lot. He finds it a bit of a bore. He's dealing with sort of servants and tradespeople the whole time. You know, he sort of says, I do get angry sometimes. I'm sorry, I get angry. But then he says, he sort of creates this sort of quite sophisticated way of expressing his anger. He says, well, I kind of say to my servants, when I get angry, I'm probably getting angry. I actually get angriest at trivial things. So take it in that spirit. What I'm getting super annoyed about is that ultimately trivial. And the big things I don't get angry about, the big things I approach these in a kind of better, from a surer footing, as it were. And what he then says is, well, I kind of think I tell my servants just ignore me. If I'm really angry and I'm spluttering and I'm sending out all kinds of cuss words and angry remonstrations, just ignore me, just treat it as for what it is. It's angry. But then he caveats that again and says, oh, but the, you know, anger can be okay if you express it like that, but then sometimes anger, it bears you up. It's this concurrence of terrible emotions that just bears you along and you just have no control. And I think that even that tiny segment, it's so rich, this tiny little segment of that essay where he talks about, you know, the bad uses of anger, but also how to deal with it. Actually a really nice illustration of our problem with anger. We all know that we get angry, you know. We all feel anger, but we find it really hard to know when the right moment comes to be angry. We find it really hard to know what the best objects of our anger are. And this is a skill that has to be developed over time. It has to be cultivated over many years. And, you know, I probably agree with Montaigne. It's probably better to get angry about trivial things in a kind of peevish way than to be consumed by a general anger, which is sort of auto self-destructive and also destructive towards others. I mean, a personal example, I cycle in London and I see anger, that kind of flash of anger all the time. People react so instinctively, aggressively to
each
other.
Well, I get angry as a cyclist and at cyclists. It's a classic case of exactly. That kind of anxiety that's there.
But it's probably better to have those flashes of anger with when you're, there's actually a high element of risk, you're annoyed at other people, than to be consumed by a kind of general rage at your position in life or other people.
But one of those things, I mean, you mentioned the example of the cyclist, you're in a kind of cocoon. And I think about anger, there are two things. We do live, I think, in an age of anxiety. Yeah. There's a lot of people who've been born in the West, into relative privilege, who've been educated, and for whom the future is uncertain for a whole variety of reasons. We all know about that. We know about the housing problem. We know about pay. There's all kinds of anxieties. And, of course, the big one, climate change, and then there's the big anxiety about that. You know, does a warmer world mean an angrier world? Well, we can discuss that at some other place. But there is this toxic mix of narcissism and anxiety compounded by social media that seems to make people angrier. And this has something, I think, to do with expectations. High expectations unfulfilled must have, I think, something to do with that.
I think social media, I think the reason why social media encourages anger or fosters anger, I mean, does it? I think it does. But I think it does for a specific reason. Anger, as Montaigne explains, is a concurrence. It can sort of emerge slowly, slowly, and then suddenly it's like this wave of anger. So lots of things can happen, trivial things, but then something happens that pushes you over the edge and it just consumes you. And I think social media certainly fosters the conditions for that. You know, you're constantly exposed to things that are irritating, to things that just, put you off your day. You a constant kind of barrage of heightened emotion. And eventually that kind of concurrence of stuff, it lends itself very well to anger. So I think there's probably a technical explanation for why social media generates anger. I mean, again, I don't think we should necessarily take that as read, but I don't know about you, Paul, but I think it does have something to do with this perception that we live in an age of rage.
I think it does. I think the thing about social media, one of the things that it cultivates and the wider media cultivates is conspiracy theories. Because conspiracy theories seem to me to be founded in this idea that I think if you study history, for example, properly, inoculates you to a certain extent away from this. And that is the inability to comprehend laughing chance, just blind contingency. Bad things happen, often for no reason. I can think of various people who've become ill. I can think of people who've, you know, died in unfortunate circumstances or just ended up in really unfortunate kind of state. It's nothing to do with them. It's nothing they've done. It's just, you know, slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And I think that that's very, very difficult to comprehend contingency. I think it's absolutely one of the reasons why the study of history should be absolutely at the forefront of the value, is it teaches you, or it should teach you, if you have a mind open enough and you have good enough teachers there, to comprehend this idea that, you know, there's often nothing we can do about it. And the Stoics understood that, certainly, for one. I think there's another thing that really strikes me. I mean, I'm old enough to have been raised in a, you know, when Christianity, in this case Anglicanism, was just part of the ether. It's a little bit like the goldfish who says, you know, are you enjoying the water? And the goldfish said, well, what's water? Christianity was just there. And one of the absolute hallmarks of Christianity is this instruction to turn the other cheek. There is that, which I've always tried to do. And if you compound that with a kind of Balfourian idea of thinking, well, actually, what really matters, then that's a fairly good concoction. But I think we are, or I fear we are in some way, returning to a pre-Christian age of rage, perhaps, where those ideas of turning the other cheek are not there, where revenge is more to the forefront of ideas. That slightly worries me. And I think another thing is, particularly about when I think about British society from, say, the 18th century onwards, and there's a lot of arguments within history now as to when this kind of civilising project happened, that there was, you know, Stephen Pinker talks about this, various other people have talked about this, about the idea that we are getting a more peaceful, as humanity has become more peaceful. I mean, I'm not at all convinced by that, but I think there was a kind of civilizing mission, is too teleological, but there was a kind of civilizing process that went on. But what replaced the physical violence, if you go to the aggression, was an aggression in language. And although I don't appreciate physical violence at all, really find it repellent, what I do love is really vicious satire. I'm a great fan of Swift. I'm a great fan of Auberon Waugh, you know, the whole kind of Peter Cook, Barry Humphreys, you know, this kind of magnificent, often cruel, quite crude satire. Even Viz magazine, that are, you know, which is for me one of those publications that casts a really cold eye on society. That I think one of the things is we mistake the physical for this literary or this cultural world that is almost a safety valve. And what worries me is because we don't have, or rather, we have restrictions now on satire, on language, that perhaps we didn't have in the immediate post-war years, and you think of the satire boom of the 60s and 70s, that safety valve is replaced by a kind of physical rage. It's better on paper than it is on the street, if you see what I mean.
But is the issue that things like social media don't get you to the same endpoints as the kind of literary, cultural set of norms that satire creates? It creates the possibility for spilling out into the physical.
Well, what really strikes me about social media, and this is from an historical aspect, is looking at a number of historians who I follow and they follow me on Twitter. If I was talking to them, you would think these are deeply civilized, deeply knowledgeable, very erudite people, and indeed they are. But I see expressions of ad hominem anger on there, really quite abusive from people. And we're talking about people who are professors or doctors or senior academics here who think nothing of offering really spiteful abuse on social media. And I think it is the lack of perhaps the physical. We wouldn't do it physically if we were one-to-one, or we would be polite to one another. We would have that kind of restraint. I'm all for hammer and tongue arguments with people about, say, historical ideas, historical theories, political ideas,
or
whatever.
The problem of anger.
Yeah, well, that is the control of it. But when it gets into anger, it destroys that debate. And I think we're increasingly seeing, I'm talking about the historical profession now, but it's way, way beyond that, that it's simply become very difficult to have very, very frank discussions because the bar to anger is now so low that a debate that should be civilised, that should be informed, there should be a kind of dialectic that advances knowledge, that advances understanding, is becoming increasingly difficult because of the early intrusion of anger into that debate. And I really, really fear for a discipline like history, which is absolutely dependent on vigorous and open debate, if it becomes ensnared by this anger, by ad hominem abuse, it will kill the discipline. And it won't just be history. It's happening in politics a lot, where people are simply unable to listen to the other side, even when they're democratic politicians committed to democratic ideals, liberal democracy. It becomes increasingly difficult for anyone to have a really serious, honest and informed debate. And that's because anger intrudes all too easily.
And at times that kind of, even people who claim they're very pro, disagreeing agreeably, isn't it? There's a kind of righteous anger that pervades the way they're talking.
Oh, absolutely. And the phrase they always use is "be kind,"
exactly.
Which is the greatest irony of all. Be kind.
But it's so true. I mean, you look at talking about the British media landscape at any rate, and perhaps there has been a general much less deferential age than maybe 50 years ago.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Not necessarily a bad thing, but also our politicians, journalists, don't speak in full sentences
the question of literacy again, isn't it? This is the question of articulacy again.
If you look at older TV debates between politicians who, on paper, are completely loathe each other, who really hate each other's guts in terms of their positions in life and philosophy, you can find almost any example on YouTube or in the BBC archive of older political debate, and there is a kind of culture of eloquence and a culture of disagreeing agreeably.
Yeah,
I always get confused.
To disagree.
But that kind of pat language of like agreeing disagreeably or disagreeing agreeably is a pretty poor compensation for a general culture of eloquent speech also understands the limits of speech and where the physical starts to intrude and takes the problem of anger seriously. It takes, it's kind of a tribute to anger to take it seriously. Anger is a really bad emotion, as we've seen. It's something that our greatest thinkers have taken super seriously and have worried about at length over hundreds of pages of text. But we simultaneously at the moment, I think, talk about an age of rage in which everyone is born up in anger and people act in very angry ways to each other. But in a way, I think, as you said, we sort of take it less seriously. We sort of think it's fine to be angry. We think it's to be angry. We think it's fine to have that righteous anger. We praise commentators who get angry in public forums, and we but we also love it when they sort of recant a bit as well. I'm really talking about the kind of centrist rage that we have in the UK, which I think James Marriott in The Times wrote well about a couple of months ago, that even people who claim to take anger really seriously and think, oh, populism is this terrible, angry disruption of the status quo, and claim to be against populist and against populist speech, also seem to take up the tools
of populism. No, absolutely.
But that is, in a sense, not taking anger seriously.
Yeah.
It's just getting angry yourself and using anger to try and beat angry people. And that, as we know, is never a good idea, because anger has its own dynamic. And it consumes. It's not something that we find, human beings find it really difficult to regulate anger. It's just a wicked problem.
And here we come back to the childlike nature of it, this narcissistic nature of it, this lack of articulacy, this inability to really try and describe the world, describe situations, to articulate ideas, to articulate concepts, to articulate policies, which our post-Reformation world, if we can call it that, and I think James, who's been a guest on this program, has articulated this extremely well, is this idea that a liberal democracy, if it is to flourish, as it did flourish in the 20th century in particular, in certain places, certainly in the UK, we'd say, in the United States, it was able to do so because there was an increasing literacy in the public sphere with people. And if we are losing that articulacy, if we are losing that literacy, if we are becoming again a pre-Reformation age, then I think that has really severe implications for the health of liberal democracy. But let me put you on the spot, Alistair, as I always do. What makes you most angry?
I would say I'm not an angry person in general, but I do get extremely annoyed, which I think is actually a very different emotion. Oh. I get peevish and annoyed, and I sometimes worry that in 20 or 30 years' time, I am going to be the most peevish sort of reactionary person ever. Yeah, completely. Yeah, just so annoyed by the way people behave. I think there's a terrible thing in the UK where we find it very difficult to censure other people when they're behaving very badly, because we're all oh so polite. I often find that, particularly on public transport or in sort of public forums, when someone is just behaving awfully, part of you goes, I don't want to make a fuss. I don't want to annoy everyone on this bus by telling off this person. I was at the opera a couple of years ago, see Peter Grimes, and someone was eating crisps throughout the first act, literally right behind me. And all I could summon up was a sort of glare occasionally behind me. I didn't, which is probably what I should have done, say, please, can you stop doing that? But then you are always nervous of expressing those kinds of emotions, because you never know how people are going to react. And that is the terrible thing about anger. You know, you never know whether you're going to get an angry reaction to something which you feel is a kind of cool and detached summation of what's happening. Mm. So I would say that I'm not instinctively angry, but I am also, I do get very annoyed and irritable. And I think that's a slight, irritable, I know, comes from the word for anger a little bit, but it, isn't, I don't think it's quite the same thing.
It anger doesn't quite suggest the same level of intensity.
No, anger really distorts the face. I find anger very difficult in other people. I find people who get angry very hard to be around. I sort of feel that it's, again, that it comes back to that, an inability to integrate certain childlike behaviours into adult life. No one's perfect, you know. Everyone is really always trying to integrate those things and behave better. But anger, I always feel it just, I sort of agree with Seneca, it's sort of the most hideous thing. So it's a terrible emotion that if it has any productive uses, if it does have a productive use, I think you should find better explanations for what you're doing than anger. I always think also in sports, which a little bit, it tends to reveal kind of extreme states. Sports people who are channeling a kind of cold, detached, not fury, but a kind of energy, aren't actually angry. That they're actually detaching themselves from whatever anger they might be feeling and doing something. You know, in cricket, again, the sports I know best, in that Lord's Test match where there was that element of sharp practice, people got really, really angry. I think it's fair to say that people were angry in the stadium. Stuart Broad came out and was clearly very angry and was sort of saying nasty things to the Australian players and was visibly almost in a state of distress. Ben Stokes, the captain at the other end, I don't think was angry. And then he played extraordinarily well. He almost won. Well, he got England halfway there to winning the game through an incredible bit of stroke play. But did he seem angry? I don't think so.
I think that's
the contrast. You know, he's able to
channel that,
to channel it, or but
what,
not even
what
to
anger
channel
he
it
has.
To say to put it aside and create this kind of displacement within himself that allows him then to do something quite extraordinary. I don't think Stuart Broad, he was able to channel it for a bit, but it sort of fails in some ways.
I actually thought the players were fine within it. They were essentially playing their roles. The Australians were playing the pantomime villain. Stuart Broad was playing Stuart Broad. Ben Stokes was playing Ben Stokes. What I found very, very surprising about it was the way that the crowd responded, as you said. It's that anger. And when I've seen it before, going back to this kind of idea of satire, there would be a kind of witty response, as there often is at sporting events, to someone's perceived mistake. But the replacement of that by anger again suggested a lack of articulacy, because cricket crowds, you know, they're sometimes witty before the drink kicks in, and football crowds similarly, they would respond in a witty way to someone they perceive as a transgressor or a villain in a pantomimish way. But what really shocked me about that particular incident when Carey stumped Johnny Bairstow was the anger that came out of it. And I thought, this is really odd, because to me, it's just sport.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter. And I was really, I thought a line was crossed, really, in the behaviour of the crowd and some commentators to take the Australians being Australian, Stuart Broad being Stuart Broad, Ben Stokes being Ben Stokes. This is what we pay them to do. This is their role. And so what actually added to the drama of this wonderful current test series was perceived as though this was wrong. I absolutely loved it. I thought they all did the right thing. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. It's exactly what we want. It's what made the drama so compelling and remains compelling until the end of this series. But again, it was a classic case of that rise in anger, in public anger, that I think was again something to do with a lack of wit and articulacy.
Yeah, and the confusion of the trivial with the
Absolutely.
Serious. And I think people
exactly.
take themselves very seriously, and they take things very seriously. And there isn't that sense of levity and lightness, which is actually crucial if you want to find value in stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the reason why people play sport or play music is not because of some serious elaboration of you know, the self and what it means to be human and all that. It's a diversion from some of the more important aspects of life, how to live, how to be a fuller person. I think that idea of going back to a pre-Christian age actually offers us some opportunities.
I mean, they're very honest in confronting what it is to be human.
Yes, there's a rich language, you know, if we can access it, and I know it's fairly, well, I don't think it actually is a high bar, but there's people read sort of Marcus Aurelius's Meditation, you know, it's something that people do. But the thing that is very popular at the moment, the big philosophical trends that is embraced by millions of people, if not billions around the world, is mindfulness. And mindfulness actually does take anger seriously. You know, mindfulness, I know, is much sort of ridiculed by certain from certain quarters, but
like
actually,
here.
Well, I'm very
including me.
Okay, Paul's very anti. Paul's very angry.
I just go to matins or evensong. Yeah. That does it for me.
Well, there are many ways of getting there. I mean, but I certainly find the kind of practice of mindfulness, meditation, all that stuff very, very helpful. And it is a practice. It's not a good idea. It's simply a practice that may or may not be helpful and may or may not connect to other philosophical traditions and broader ideas of what it means to be human. But, for example, mindfulness does take anger seriously. It does take the world of the emotions seriously. It takes seriously that process we must all go through to live with the kind of more extreme, the tougher sides of life, and learn ways of dealing with those things in a way that don't destroy us or don't destroy other people.
No,
Paul,
what makes
you angry?
Before I do that, I should just say that I think there is also, we often forget the continuity between the classical world and the Christian world as well. They are continuous in one sense. I think this is made very, very clear in a wonderful book that I always plug by Richard Jenkins called Classical Literature, which is one of the great works of just literary scholarship that I know of. But it emphasises very, very clearly the continuity between the Greeks, the Romans, and the Christian world that remains with us. So I think that relationship is actually more problematic than we think. But you're asking what makes me angry? Not much, really. Alistair Campbell.
We've sort of alluded to Alistair Campbell throughout, because he is actually a great example of someone who is visibly angry in public forums, but then talks about how it's very important that we all find better ways of talking to each other. And we've apologies to listeners, but I kind of wanted to say Alistair Campbell throughout the episode, but sort of couldn't, because I felt maybe it's a bit mean.
I think that we come back to the wise words of Arthur Balfour that I think we should stick with, that I still subscribe to the philosophy, by and large, that nothing matters very much and few things matter at all. And I think that's actually something that you do learn with age, going on this kind of journey from the childlike, bellicose kind of anger that a child has with those frustrations and the inability to articulate problems. I think as you get older, you do realise things like contingency matters. You do realise that blind chance element of life. And you, if you've got any sense, you kind of go with it and realise that, you know, concentrate on the things that really do matter, because there aren't many of them. And that's a pretty good inoculation to anger.